This week on the Dragzine Podcast, we talked to the NMCA's most winning driver, Andy Warren, about his championships, what got him into racing, and a whole lot more. So, pull those belts tight. Get ready to put in the beans. The Dragzine Podcast starts now. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Dragzine Podcast. I'm your host, Senior Associate Editor Brian Wagner. This week on the show, Andy Warren joins us. We kind of get to hear a little bit about what got him into racing and what it's taken to win all of these championships and all the wins that he has. And it's a pretty interesting conversation. So without further ado, let's get this drag racing party started. All right, my guest this week on the Dragzine Podcast is the winningest driver in the history of the NMCA, Andy Warren. What's going on, Andy?
And how are you?
Doing good. Getting ready here for PRI and getting to hang out with all the racing friends. You heading up to PRI this year?
Sure am. The NMCA always holds their award ceremony at PRI, usually on the Friday evening. So I get to go and get up on stage and get the award for my 8th Nostalgia Muscle Car Championship. Pretty excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, kind of, there's a lot to unpack here. And before we talk about, you know, kind of what got you into racing, to set the table for the listeners, here's a list of Andy Warren's stats in the NMCA. 87 event wins, 217 round wins.
Hold on, let me stop you. It's 87 events.
Oh, 87 events.
Yeah, 30 wins.
30 wins. All right.
You want to start over?
No. That works.
Oh, okay.
I just read it wrong there. I was like, didn't even make sense.
Yeah.
Here's
wow,
the thing.
A lot of wins.
Well, here's the thing: is you like have won so much that wouldn't surprise me at all. But you know, like you said, 217 round wins, 30 event wins, 13 runner ups, 43 finals, 51% winning percentage in the final round, 8 championships, 4 runner-ups, 12 out of the 14 last seasons you've been in the top 2. Pretty much at this point, I'm wondering if Steve Walcott is just going to name the trophy after you because you pretty much own that thing.
Yeah, I mean, everybody says that I make it look easy, but it's not. Man, it is a lot of work in between, you know, just getting to know the car, a lot of practice in between. And, you know, the class is really competitive. I mean, you know, every year we usually have 40 to 50 people in point standings. You know, we have probably 15 to 20 regulars. So, you know, it's not like just 2 or 3 regulars showing up and, you know, I make a race and end up winning points. But, you know, the class is really tough. I mean, it's getting tougher every year.
Oh, yeah. It's, to me, that's one of the cool things about the NMCA is, you know, those index kind of classes and the variety, seeing how tough it is. And speaking of variety, you pretty much drive a tank on rubber tires with that Caprice. You know, that thing's a monster. How did, you know, we had a Caprice growing up as a kid, you know, it was a beastly of a car. I never thought of it as a race car. How did you end up with a 71 Caprice as a race car?
Well, it's funny. Our family has a long, extensive history with, you know, running demolition derbies back in the day from, you know, the 80s to the early 90s. You know, and, you know, my dad and my uncle were, you know, they were the kings around this area of that stuff. So we kind of knew the car, those kind of cars, like the back of our hand, which is pretty cool. So, you know, it was getting time for me to be looking for a car to drive. I was, you know, 15 years old. And I was looking around the bargain marts and, you know, we didn't have the internet back then. So, you know, the first car I looked at was a 66 Plymouth station wagon, even bigger. But we went and looked at it. It wasn't what I thought it was. And then later on, I saw the ad for this Caprice. It said 1971 Chevrolet Caprice. One owner car, had 94,000 miles on it. And it said 400. And I know the 71 Impalas Caprices had the 400 badges on the front. Sometimes it was a small block, 400 small block, or it was a 402 big block. So I was like, oh, yeah, this could be a big block car. And so I called the number. This little old lady answered the phone. And we started talking about it. It was her husband's car, and he passed away. And the car was just too big for her to drive around. She was driving a little tempo around. And so I asked her, yeah, is that a big 400 or a little one? And she's like, oh, it's a big one. So I got all pumped up, told my dad about it, and we drove up to Louisville, which is about an hour from me, and to go look at it. And she opens the garage door. Here it is, hubcaps on it. I mean, it was really good shape. Popped the hood. It was a small block. You know, I guess she figured, you know, it was a big motor, you know, 400. It was big, but it ended up being a small block car. So we walked around, talked to her about it, and we got the car down to $1,250. And she's like, well, I'll let you have it for this price as long as you promise to bring it back and let me see it every now and then. So Dad and I took the car home, and I started driving. It's about a year later. Like every couple of years, I would bring it by, I'd show it to her. I think she passed away in 2003. And that's right around when I started doing a lot more modifications to the car where I couldn't drive it anymore anyway. But, so that's kind of how the car started as far as me getting in the big boat. But, you know, started out drag racing. That's a funny story, too. I was 14, I think. I was in ninth grade. And my brother John, a lot of you guys know John. He races the black and yellow, or yellow and black 72 Nova. He used to run Extreme Street in MCA, and he's prepping the car now to run LDR. Anyway, he would drive the car to Hardinsburg, US 60 Raceway, which is about an hour west of here, and he'd run Saturday night there, running their trophy class, and I would go along with him. And John was racing his car. And I ran into a guy. This is funny. I was in ninth grade, and there's already a kid driving. I guess he failed a couple of years, but he came up to me. He's like, "Man, I can't cut a light for anything in this car." I was like, "Well, you know what? Let me try it out." And that's kind of, you know, US 60. It's kind of an outlaw track. You know, they're pretty loose on the rules. So, and they allowed passengers at the time. So I hopped in, and it's already elimination time. He just threw a dial in on the window, and I get out there, and I started drilling the tree, going around. I ended up getting a runner-up that night, brought a trophy home. And, I figured my dad would be pretty mad about it, but you know, he was excited I got a trophy. But then after that, I kind of talked my mom and dad into, you know, taking me out to the racetrack in their car and just letting me bracket racing on Saturday in the trophy class. So mom had a 92 Ford Tempo at the time. And I started just cleaning house. I mean, winning trophies left and right, and ended up winning the points championship, the trophy, or the street eliminator class on Saturday nights that year. Got invited to race the bracket finals, like Division III bracket finals. And I wasn't even old enough to drive yet. They didn't have junior dragsters at the time. So the next year came around. I was 15 years old. That's when we got the Caprice. And so then they started driving me to the track in that, and I was racing that. And then Dad and I would just make little modifications here and there. And, you know, got the car. It was, you know, 402 barrels, single exhaust, 273 gears. And I think it ran like 1060s in the 8th mile or something like that. It was really slow. And Dad ended up jetting the 2-barrel and putting headers and flow matchers on it for me. Went out there, it ran like 960s and 8th mile. I picked up almost a whole second just by doing all that. And then I started driving at the high school. And then we put a 4-barrel intake on it, quarter jet. And then from after that, after I graduated high school, I started working a lot, going to college and everything. So I was just driving the car. And I think what year was it? It was probably 98 or 99. We built a pretty healthy 406 for it. And it had a pretty decent set of cast iron heads on it. And you know, we didn't run an 8th mile or a quarter mile much at all. And I think an 8th mile was running like 870s. And that's pretty fast for a little street car around here, a big street car. But I drove it that way probably for 4 or 5 years on the street. I mean, it was my daily driver every day. And so, you know, we just stuck around here racing. And, you know, back in the early 90s when NMCA was, you know, huge, you know, when they had the world finals in Memphis, you know, thousands of people would show up for the, you know, when the whole fastest street car boom was going on, John and I, we would make the trek out to Memphis every year. And, you know, it was always a dream of ours, you know, to run a big series like that. But we never had the money, or, you know, just for the time off to do it, and or a car fast enough, you know. So so we're always a big fan of that. And I started working full time, getting a little bit more money, some vacation time. And here it is, it's 2004 now. So I started looking online. I just had the itch to race somewhere, do something different. You know, I was playing music for a long time. I played drums for some metal bands in between high school and that time. And, you know, I wanted to take a break from that and, you know, spend some more time with my family, my dad, my brother, my mom. And, you know, racing was the thing to do, to, you know, have all that quality time with them. So I just Googled NMCA because I just wanted to see if it was still around. And it was. And so I started looking through all the rule sets and everything. And I saw Nostalgia Muscle Car. I was like, well, that sounds pretty cool, because I was always a fan of Nostalgia Superstock when we used to go back in the, you know, the 90s to go watch. I always thought that was one of the coolest classes there. And so I started going through all the rules, and my car fit perfect. And the next event was at Beach Bend in Bowling Green, which is about an hour and a half from me. And so we hauled the car down, got there on Friday, made, you know, went through all the qualifying passes. And I was just excited just to be a part of something like that. The whole place was packed full of people. And red light first round. That was it. It was over. So I didn't race any more events after that. I kind of just stuck around here. And I was like, looking at the schedule again, I was like, wow, well, you know, the World Final was in Memphis. So I was like, that'd be a dream come true, because, you know, that's where John and I always went to watch the big race. And So talked to my dad. We got some called, got a hotel room reserved, made the drive all the way out to Memphis. And if you look back through the history books, that is the NMCA World Finals that ran for 5 days. And we ended up finishing a race on Tuesday, I think it was. But so a lot of good things happened about the whole rainout thing. I got to meet a lot of nice people. So I think we qualified on Friday. Saturday rained out. Sunday rained out. And I ended up running to Scott Sparrow at the hotel. He was the editor of Fastest Street Car Magazine at the time, NMCA's magazine. And so I talked to him, and he said he was looking for cars to do stories on, and I told him about mine, and he wanted to come look at it. So on Sunday, I think we had rain again, but he ended up doing a whole photo shoot on my car, and I ended up going rounds, ended up winning the whole thing. I won the race. So my second NFCA race, I ended up getting the race win. And it's funny, I only made two events. I made top 10 in points. That was 10th in points. So I was all ready to go after that. You know, 2005 came around. Oh, funny! Another funny thing about that year in 2004, my first year in NCA, every day it rained, I would call in to work. Like on Monday, I was like, hey, I'm not going to make it. I'm here in Memphis. They said, no, it's fine. Don't worry about it. And I called in Tuesday, same thing. Ended up driving all night Tuesday to get home. And Wednesday morning went to work. I got laid off that day. So, I don't know. That was just the crazy time right there. So I ended up working another job in between that to where I am now. And so in 2005, I didn't get to travel like I wanted to. I made two events again. I made Bowling Green and Memphis again. Now I won like one or two rounds, and that was it. So 2006 came around. I'm at the job I have now. I actually got some vacation time. So I talked to my dad. I was like, hey, let's give NMCA a go. Let's try to win a points championship. So at the time, my car was running like, I think it was running like 12 flat or something like that. So yeah, we've done some pretty good modifications to it. We put a set of aluminum heads on it, pretty aggressive gear. I mean, it's still streetable. You know, we drove it around a lot. So 2006 came around. I made 6 out of the 7 events. I think I won one and runned up another one or something. Ended up getting second in points. And so 2007, I didn't do so good. 2008, I started doing a lot better. We got teamed up with Canarium Racing Engines. Built a pretty good 406 for it. The car started running like 10 80s or 10 90s. So I was running 11 flat index every race, and came down, and Ralph Saran, a racer from New Jersey, he and I battled it out all year long, and he ended up winning the championship like a couple rounds, so I got runner-up again. And then 2009 came around, won my first championship. It was, I mean, it was awesome. Kept the car the same, and then 2010 won my second championship in a row. And then I thought, man, I should use these championships to my advantage. So I started calling around, trying to, you know, making sponsorship proposals, things like that. I was a big learning process. So we ended up building a pretty nasty 427 for the car. I mean, dart block, dart heads. It was brutal. It ended up going like 10-30s in the quarter. So in 2011, I had this whole fresh combination, and I was like, man, I don't know how I'm going to do, because I got to relearn the car all over again, because I had the 406 in the car for so long. I was so used to it. Well, I think 2011 was probably the most successful year I've had, because I think I had like 3 or 4 event wins and 1 runner-up. And it seemed like I was unstoppable, and I won that championship. Didn't do so good in 2012, 2013. I think 13, I was runner up in points. And 14, I lost the championship by like 15 points, which is just qualifying points. And then 15, I started turning things back around. We took 427 out, and Tim Canarian went through it. We put a massive set of AFR heads on it, bore it out to make it a 434, and the car went like 9.8. It's just crazy how fast that car has gone. So won the championship 15, 16, 17. I mean, I've since then won 5 championships in a row, and the years have flown by, but a lot of work in between. And it's just unbelievable how, you know, the success I've had with it. And, I just can't believe it. It's nuts.
You know, with being so successful and, you know, index style racing is, you know, it's a lot like bracket racing. You know, is a lot of this attributed to just how well you know the car and how, what it's going to do? You know, what's your, I guess, for lack of better terms, what's the secret to the success you have with this car?
I think a lot of it's conditioning too. I mean, you have to have a great car to trust in, but you know, conditioning too, you get bracket racing weekend after weekend, just getting a process down and taking that same process every time. In 2011, when we were building the 427 for my car wasn't ready for the season opener. So I reached out, and I talked to Derek Putnam, who writes for Fast Street Car Magazine as well. He had his Nova available. So I was like, you know what? He said, you can come down and race it. I was like, really? So I booked a flight, went down and raced it. I ended up getting runner-up in that, and in that car. So, you know, I'm thinking, man, it's just crazy. I could just hop in somebody's car and make the finals. Well, 2013, my car wasn't ready yet. So I flew down, drove Derek's best friend, Jason Rollins, his Nova. Ended up making it to the semifinals. And then another year, let's see, I think it was 15 or 16, my wife and I drove down and borrowed Jason Rollins' dad's Malibu station wagon. Never seen the car before in my life. So we drove their shop, picked it up, got to the track, unloaded it, ended up making it. I can't remember how I qualified, but I won the whole event in that little Malibu. It was just crazy. And I was just like, wow, I could just hop in anything, you know? And that, I think what it takes is just conditioning and just having a set process every time, just kind of, you know, wash, rinse, repeat kind of thing. Which kind of leads to where I'm kind of advancing right now. The last couple of years, I've gotten to know Scott Libisher, who he races NMCA and NHRA, and this guy has this whole fleet of Copo Camaros. And it started out just a friendship. You know, I would just drive by, wave at the guy, and I would just joke around, hey, man, you need to put me in one of your Copos. And he was kind of just laugh, you know, because he didn't really know me so well. And this was, this was last year, you know, 2018. And eventually, I started going by his pits, and, you know, started helping him wrench on his cars and getting to know him a little bit. And then September, which was to be the World Finals last year, he sent me a text message. He's like, "Hey, man, I'm going to be shorthanded. I was wondering if you and your brother could help me out on the track." So he's running these, you know, the factory stock showdown car, or what's the NMCA called? Factory supercar category. So, you know, used cars are around 790. So, you know, John and I, we have quite a bit of heads-up experience. You know, John running his Nova and Extreme Street, and, you know, we help crew for, you know, Craig Watson, Tim Canarium, and a lot of other people. So, you know, we know what we're doing out on the track, too. So John and I went out there, and we helped Scott and his son and his son-in-law in the burnout box and get them lined up on the track. And Scott ended up running, like, his fastest pass of the weekend and locked in. He didn't lock in the championship that weekend, but he ended up doing really well, and just really impressed with how John and I handled things. And he came to me at PRI last year. He's like, "Hey, I'm going to actually put you in one of these cars next year." And I was like, "What, really?" And he's like, "Yeah." So he has the Gas Monkey Garage Coco Camaro, the one that they built on one of their episodes on the show. You know, Richard Rawlings got a ticket to go to Detroit and build one of the Copos. Well, Scott ended up buying this car at Barrett Jackson, and that's kind of how he got started in drag racing. Was he had that car, he took it out and raced it quite a bit. And so that car was just a spare car at his shop. He wanted to put me in it. I didn't get to race it in Bradenton this year or Atlanta. This logistics didn't work out because he was already hauling like four or five cars down. So his stacker was full, and it was just costing me a bunch of money to have somebody pick it up and drive it down for me and everything. I just didn't have the budget for it. So he finally worked it out to where he can get the car to Memphis for me this year. And, see, NMCA has the stock superstock combo, which he was running his stock Eliminator cars in. And I didn't want to end up racing the same class with them and end up having to race each other. Either I put him out or he put me out. It would be cool. So I have ended up entering in the LSX Challenge Series, the Street King category, which is like an index class like what I run now in the Nostalgia Muscle Car. So I was like, "Hey, I already know what I'm doing here." So, but it's on a pro tree. So here I am. I never sat in a car before, never driven one. So I fired it up, go in the burnout box, do a pretty good burnout. And all I didn't realize was they had the car set up pretty loose to do big wheelies and everything. And, you know, the Caprice does a pretty good wheelie, but it doesn't really carry it out real far. So I get on the two-step, let off the brake. This thing just shoots straight up in the air. And, I hit panic mode. I was like, "Oh, God, I'm in somebody else's car. It's worth more than my house. What do I do?" So and the car kind of shot left a little bit. So I dropped it down. I coasted down the track. I got back to the pits, and they saw me get out of the car. I was just shaking like a leaf. And so I talked to Scott and his son-in-law, Danny. I was like, "Man, you guys got to kill some power or something, or get this thing settled down just so I can get used to it." And so they slowed it down. I was going to try to run the 950 index and end up going like 930s, 940s. I didn't do so hot. You know, it's my first race in the car. And so after that was a divisional at NHRA divisional, Division III race in Joliet. So I booked a flight, flew out to Chicago, and met up with Scott and his crew, and got to race the car in a divisional race, and got a little bit more seat time in it. I still didn't do so hot. Then was in NMCA Joliet, kind of the same scenario, you know, just trying to get used to the car. And Scott's like, "Man, I got to get you some more seat time in this thing." And so there was an NHRA, I think it's called a regional event. It's like a smaller, like 8-mile race. It used to be called the Door Slammer Nationals at Ohio Valley Dragway. But they changed the name and the date of it. They moved it from October to August or something like that. Well, Scott brought his stock limiter car and the gas monkey car for me to drive. I ended up making like 12 to 15 laps in it. Started getting really used to it. We loosened the front end up, started doing big wheelies. Got my first round win in it. I was real excited. So after that was NMCA Norwalk. And he signed me up to race. This year at Norwalk, they had the 50th anniversary Coco shootout. And I think they had like 80-something cars pre-registered. So there, the staging lanes, like there were like six staging lanes, all of them were full of Copos when we did time runs. And coming off this race at Ohio Valley, I was hot in the seat, I was ready. And I made some killer hits in the car. I made a really good hit in the Caprice. I was racing both at the same time. And on Saturday was the eliminations for the Copo shootout. And so out of 80, I think it was like 82 cars, I get down to four, got down to semifinals. And it was just, it was sick because, you know, it was like $5,000 to win. And I was in a car that I've never set foot in until like a couple months ago. And I'm doing this well in it. So I'm thinking, you know, if I could do this well here, I can go anywhere and probably, you know, go a bunch of rounds, win some races. So, yeah, I got down to four cars out of 82 cars. And Scott was really happy about that. And, you know, along the way, I've gotten some pretty good sponsorship on board with this car, too. You know, Lucas Oil stepped up, E3. So I'm already getting sponsorship support on this car. So I'm thinking in 2020, I'm going to take a pretty good shot at, you know, trying for a championship in both classes, you know, in NMCA, Nostalgia Muscle Car, and their stock super stock category. And then if time allows and budget too, I may try to make all the rest of the Division III races around this area. And who knows, maybe try to do the U.S. Nationals or something like that. That'd be pretty sweet. That's always been a dream of mine too.
Well, you know, with, you know, between the Copo and the Caprice, is there any similarities between the cars when you're kind of jumping around in cars like that? Or again, is it just, you know, kind of, you don't really see the car as much as you just kind of do your own routine?
Well, the only thing that is the same is really kind of the driving style. You know, both cars are foot brake and just shifting, you know, the three-speed shifter. That's the only thing that's the same. You know, the Copo leaves on a two-step. It's popping wheelies past the 60-foot mark, and, you know, I'm trapping at, like, almost 150 miles an hour. I think I did one upper 148 in Ohio. And, you know, the Caprice is pretty smooth. I mean, it launches pretty hard, but it doesn't feel like quite like the Copo does. You know, the Copo really pulls some Gs when it takes off. So, yeah, that's funny because my dad and I were just talking about that today, about how, you know, it's crazy I can just hop in two separate cars and just do so well at each event. Cause while I was racing the Copo this year, I won two NMCA events and the Caprice. So, you know, neither one was throwing me off. So I think, you know, like we talked about earlier, it's just a matter of just getting in the seat and just keeping your, you know, the driving the car was different, but your routine is the same. You know, you do the same thing before the round, you get in the car, you suit up, you take a deep breath. You know, you do the burnout the same, you clean it out just the same, you stage the same in both cars. And, you know, if you get your routine down, you can be very successful at it. You know, you take a lot of notes. You know, I don't keep a paper logbook, but I have an app on my iPad. It's pretty awesome. I don't know if the maker makes it anymore. It's called Race IQ, which you can go in and log your runs, log your weather data, then you can do charts and compare and everything else. It's pretty awesome.
Well, and I think that's what, you know, kind of with the podcast, we've talked to some pretty successful bracket racers, like that kid that won that $500,000 up in Michigan in a truck that, you know, he'd never been in before, really. And it all comes down to, the, you know, with what bracket racers do. And where you got to give credit where credit's due, you know, heads up racers, you know, it's glamour, it's glitz, they're really fast. But bracket racers, it's like this, in, you know, when I say bracket index, you know, they all kind of fall in that whole deal.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's this like, it's really a science if you look at it from a high level, because the data recording you do and the fact that you'll see at some of these events, the bracket racers show up, you know, the day of, like on a Sunday. And they'll make maybe one or two hits, and then they're good to go. That's all they need.
Yeah, it's like with me, when I pull into an event with the Caprice, you know, right off the trailer, you know, I'll make a tuning adjustment. I'll look at my weather station, and I have to run an index. So I'm either 10.25 or 10 flat. Depends on which one I pick. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, first run right off the trailer, I'm within 0.02 of a second, no matter if I'm, you know, if I'm 600 miles away from home or, you know, 100 miles away from home, you know, I've got all this data that, you know, that you know, it tells you what it's going to do, and you just make the adjustments, and bam, you know, if your car is consistent, you're going to make it.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that a lot of racers really overlook, because they get caught up in the doodads and the wizardries of electronics and everything else. And a lot of times, you know, you see some of the very successful old school racers that, like you said, it was a pen, paper, you know, they look at a weather station or, you know, just, you know, what the weather was that day. And they can tell you what the car is going to run, what, you know, they know what adjustments that they'll need to make. And it just, the car does what it needs to do. And, you know, and I think even beyond that, maybe you can, you know, chime in on this is, you know, how important is it to be able to adjust, you know, or figure out or troubleshoot when the car doesn't do what it's supposed to do? Is that something a lot of people maybe overlook?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have that problem a lot, you know, because, you know, my combination is so refined, you know, with my car, because it just repeats over and over and over again. That's just a matter of having the right engine builder, having the right transmission in the car, having just, everything just works so flawlessly. It's kind of up to me, you know. It's like, if the car doesn't run the number, it's something I've done. And but what a lot of index racers, you know, the kind of mistakes they make is, you know, they kind of set themselves up to where they don't have enough. You know, a lot of times, you know, I'm going to run, you know, 7 flat index today, and your car runs 690 in good weather. You know, you get there, you're running, you know, it's, you know, the weather's predicting to be like 95 degrees and, you know, 3,500 feet density altitude and all that stuff. So you're going to be stuck running, you know, 17s. And it just, that's what's nice about, you know, Nostalgia Muscle Car is, you know, you've got some adjustability on what index to pick. So, you know, you've got anywhere from, you know, I think it's 950 now down to, it was 14 flat. I think they just did a rule change where it's down to 16 flat. So, you know, anybody can run. So it's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, kind of going off of that, that's one of the cool things that I've always enjoyed about going to NMCA events. You know, whether it's crewing, racing myself, or, you know, doing the media coverage, is like those meat and potato classes of, you know, Nostalgia Superstock, probably one of my favorites.
Yeah, mine too. Yeah, I love that class.
And then Nostalgia Muscle Car. And then that stock superstock combo to me is badass. And that's cool you get to race in that, because you see a lot of, when you go to these different events, you know, you got your core guys that are traveling with the NMCA, but then you never know what special guest might appear at one of these races that's trying to turn up for an NHRA race.
And right,
And that makes it interesting.
Yeah, it's like, that's what was really cool about the Cocoa Shootout. You know, I was racing a lot against a lot of big names. You know, I got down to the semifinals with, one of the Elite Motorsports guys. You know, I got down to the semis with him, and, you know, he and I have a hell of a race. I was like 22 on the treat, he was 15, and I ran like 5,000 under and he was 5 above or something like that. So we had a really good race, and, you know, he's one of the top dogs in the, you know, in the industry. And here I am running right with him. And, you know, that's another good cool thing about NCA is, you know, they've got something, a little something for everybody. And that's what kind of sparked me in the first place was, you know, hey, they've got a class for me, and, you know, they've got a class for anything. I mean, if you got a trans brake in your car and, you know, you bracket race a lot, hey, you can go run Oakland Common, no problem. You know, if you're a foot breaker, you know, you're old school as can be, you're shifting with your hands, and you got a car, you know, like a 72 Nova, it's a little 350 in it, and it runs, you know, it runs 12 flat or something like that. Yeah, hey, you fit perfect in muscle car. Or if you got an LS power car like you do, you can run either Open Comp, or you can go to LSX Challenge Series. You can do True Street. I mean, there's just plenty to do.
Oh, yeah. That's the cool thing, I think. Again, you know, I've talked about this countless times on the show, is how involved the NMCA brings people in. And you never know when, you know, like in your case, someone could just, you know, kind of get hooked, and all of a sudden, you know, they're a prolific racer in the series.
I've seen it happen a lot. I've seen a lot of True Street racers just branch over and then become, you know, really hard hitters in the index classes or heads up classes. So yeah, you're right about that.
Oh, the True Street is insane because, you know, I write stories and features on so many different cars, and you're starting to see more people of that generation. You know, before it was, you know, some of the older school cars, well, you know, it was a street car, bracket race, yada yada yada. Now you're starting to see the guys, well, I ran True Street and that wanted me to go faster and faster, and then, you know, all of a sudden they've got a X275 car that literally they've owned for 25 years that used to be a street car that
Right.
they
Yep.
came to one True Street event, and all of a sudden they see all this other stuff going on. They're like, man, I want to be a part of that, and boom, there you go.
Right. It's kind of how my brother's Nova evolved, you know, in the street car. And then this is his first car, and my Caprice is my first car. You know, we watched in MCA back in the 90s, and then, you know, he bracket raced for a little bit. Then he started racing heads up stuff around here. Got into the 8.5-inch tire stuff, and then just put a bigger tire on. 10.5 stuff was still big at the time. And then 2010, he's like, you know what, I'm gonna run Extreme Street. And so he built the car specifically for that and started running that. And then, you know, we were excited about his first 8-second pass. He got into 850s in the quarter, 790s, and then he ended up eventually running like 761, I think, is his fastest pass. And you know, that just blows me away because, you know, here we are, just some, you know, average country boys out here running that fast. And now he's setting his car up to run limited drag radial. So you know, he's going to be pushing 2,800 to 3,000 horsepower in his car, you know, on leaf springs. And so you know, he's going to be running some of like the LDR schedule, like the prize fight, maybe some of the Ducks races down in Georgia. Maybe some of the stuff in Memphis. And I think I caught wind there might be an LDR special event at one of the NMCA races this year. So that'd be pretty sweet to have them, you know, travel with us again. So.
Yeah, that's cool. I think it's at the St. Louis race. They're having like a Saturday night shootout with like three radial tire classes and
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I wasn't aware. I just saw like in the rules where they said LDR rules coming soon or whatever, but
yeah, I'm pretty sure.
that'd be sweet, yeah.
Pretty sure it's going to be St. Louis. They're going to have like LDR, Radial versus the World, and maybe X, which to me is awesome because, you know, growing up, one of the cool things to me, you know, bracket racers fill the coffers, but they don't fill the seats. Dog and pony shows are what fill the seats. And that's
Sure.
what, you know, for a while, people were booking in Street Outlaw Stars or Wheel Standers and stuff like that. And that's what you need to get the people in the seats. And bringing
Sure.
in radial tire cars like that to an NMCA event where they know they're going to have good prep for like just a good old one day Saturday night shootout deal, that's pretty awesome. Because to me, radial tire racers now are like the, you know, when, Nitro cars used to do match races. That's what they kind of are almost.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They're
I agree, man.
outlaws, and that's, you know, that's what people want to see. That, you know, they want to see the Outlaw 10.5 Freak Show and stuff like that. That's what the, you know, the fans want to see. And then as a racer, you know, when that stuff's going on, if you're not, you know, thrashing, you're sitting in the stands because you want to see this insanity too.
That's where I'm at. Yeah, I'm always like, oh, I gotta go. Be right back. So this was nice, but I have a low maintenance car as I get to watch. I get a lot of bleacher time too. So, but yeah, I'm excited about John's car. Hopefully, a lot of the hard work has been done. He's got the engine in the car. It's Tin Canarian built him a 540 cubic inch big block for it. I think it's got a set of SR20 heads on it. He's got a Pro Charger F3 136. It's going to be run on methanol. It's going to be pretty nasty. We're going to have a big learning curve. And, you know, we came from carbureted and nitrous. Now we're going to go to EFI with, you know, twice as much horsepower. So, you know, I don't expect to break any records, you know, first few races. But I think, you know, eventually we'll get there. You know, if we run some 430s, 420s in the car, I think we'll be more than happy with that. And, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say, Pro Charger with Zoomies, make sure you invest in good hearing protection.
Yeah, I have a set of radios. I just don't know how well that's going to work. I'll just have to. That was John's goal with the Zoomies. He's like, I want to see people's hats fly off and I do a burnout. Well, I think it's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. It's going to happen, and he's going to do that first WAP burnout, and he's going to go, man, that's kind of loud.
So, yeah, the engine is done. It's in the car, and transmission's in. He did some work on the back end to get the big, I think it's a 295 radio. I'm not too certain on the size. The plumbing's done, and then the next step is to take the car to Haltech, which they're about an hour from us, and they're going to put their ECM in the car and wire the car up, and they've got the hub dyno there, so why not? What better place to do it? So, you know, we get the car fired up and strap it right on the dyno. So we're hoping to have that done probably within the next couple of months. We've got a lot going on here at home, too. You know, it's hard to... Yeah, I've been really lucky to be able to keep racing. We've had some family health issues and stuff. And, you know, that's tying up a lot of John's time and my time, too. But now that, you know, he's got a lot of hard work going on in the car, we should be able to focus on getting his car out a lot more this year and this coming year.
You mentioned hub dynos, which to me, that's those things are an amazing invention for heads up high horsepower racers, because you see videos floating around them all the time, and the shock value of seeing a high horsepower car gets a lot of clicks. But from a racer's point of view, that's a pretty solid tuning tool.
It is. It's kind of scary looking to me. And I think somebody just shared it. I think Dragzine just shared a video of a guy on a hub dyno and ended up having some kind of explosion or something.
Yeah, I was down in Australia.
Yeah, but I see drivers, you know, behind the wheel of the cars on the dyno like that with no protection on at all. You know, the t-shirt and shorts. And I'm like, man, these guys are crazy, especially running methanol and everything else. So, yeah, guys, if you're on the dyno, yeah, put a helmet on and a fire jacket or something.
Well, yeah, Lewis from Fuel Tech wears, you know, the helmet, the fire suit, the whole deal when they've got him on there.
Yeah, I've seen Lyle Barnett on one before where he had the whole shebang on too. And,
That Australia deal was kind of crazy. I wrote the story on that. I think it was a rotary car, and ended up having something in the oiling system, a line broke, and it basically just turned the car into a freaking, you know, an afterburner pumping oil in there. The guy was lucky. He got out of the car and he had some singed hair, and that was about it.
Yeah, good thing he's all right.
But, you know, again, I think with people go with those hub dynos because it gives you an opportunity to do tuning before you get to the track, so you're not wasting any time at the track. And I think that's what's made a lot of these cars that you're seeing come out and be successful right away as new cars, because they've already got, like, the tune almost where they wanted to have it at.
Well, like the wheel dynos, they're effective too, but once you get to a certain power range, you're going to start spinning the tires or messing the dyno up too, so... Yeah, they're a really nice tool that came out.
Oh yeah, you know it's amazing to watch what they can do with those now and what they simulate and, you know, the testing that they can do. And it's, you know, for those that have had to try to shake down, you know, a heads up or a high horsepower car, it can be a maddening process when, you know, you're fighting tune up issues on top of chassis issues and God knows what.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. With the Nova, man, we've got a long way to go because with this big, you know, major change we've done. And, you know, with John, you know, he's been in heads-up racing for a long time. I still get the itch, you know, with this new DXP Street class that came out. I was like, man, I would love to have a car for that. You know, it just seems so cool. And somewhat of an entry-level heads-up class, you know, a little lower horsepower, but, you know, the cars are still going to fly. I mean, guarantee that. You can guarantee that, but, you know, if I ever had the budget, you know, I would probably go that route, not to keep the Caprice the way it is. You know, I always want to make the Caprice faster and faster and faster. I see all this donk racing going on down south.
Oh, Lord.
You know, these guys down there, or, you know, I've heard rumors of them going 950s, like 150 miles an hour on those big wheels.
That's terrifying.
It is. And it upsets me because I haven't been 950s yet. So, you know, I've been 985 at 134 or something like that. But, you know, I've raced that car for a long time, and I always thought I had the fastest one around, and I wish I did. And, you know, maybe one of these days, you know, if I put Nostalgia Muscle Cars out, I might do something to, you know, make some road trips down south and do some grudge racing with it or something with some of those guys. maybe get my car down in the eights or something.
Those
it wouldn't be too far.
Those cars are just nuts because they're running, you know, a lot of them are LS based and they're running, you know, either huge hitch nitrous, that 1200 horsepower turbo engines. And like you said, on those little teeny tiny tires. And we've done our fair share of stories of, some things that were overlooked in the, you know, the technical side of, you know,
part of it.
rear ends flying out, wheel studs breaking, you know, there's a lot of physics involved with those cars. And, you know, going that fast to me on those tires would just be like, it'd be like in an old, you know, covered wagon buggy, just holding on for dear life.
Well, now that it's gotten so big, there's a lot of big names getting involved with it too. As far as, you know, I saw Jason Gatlin from ATF Transmissions working on some of those cars. So, you know, you get these bigger names out there, these guys are going to be even faster. Yeah. And I caught rumors that I think somebody's going to put a 481X in one of these cars.
Oh, I need to see this.
I'm buddies with Fletcher Cox, and I texted him, and I was like, hey, I know he has a 76, I think, 75 or 76 in Dallas. I texted him. I was like, yeah, I heard somebody was putting a 481X in one of those. Was it you? He's like, hell no. He said, I'll drive mine. That's just nuts. That's, man.
Yeah.
If somebody does that, I'll just hang it up. I'll just hang it up and drop something else.
Yeah. At that point, it's like, you know, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Anything can be possible with, you know, a plasma cutter and a little bit of ingenuity, but man, that, you know,
a lot of money.
Yeah, that's like those Russians that built that 481X powered Nissan Skyline that was still all-wheel drive.
Oh shit.
That car was just, it's got this like crazy eagle graphics on it. I talked to the dude and he's, you know, he's about as Russian gangster as it comes. Nice guy, but just, you know, they built that thing in, you know, this tiny shop, and they're, you know, last I saw they're having problems like trying to make the all wheel drive system work on that car because they have enough issues just with, you know, your typical, you know, Nissan Skyline, the GTR like driveline, but then you slap a freaking 481X in that thing with twin turbos and They said that they were promised that the front diff and the axles would work on that first hit, and they just destroyed them.
It's insane.
You know, you mentioned DXP Street, which, you know, you watch that class kind of, what Duck's doing with that. And, you know, to me, affordability and heads-up racing usually aren't two words that kind of go hand in hand. But with what they're trying to do with that class and limiting a lot of it, I think that's kind of interesting, especially with the plate that they're – the way that they're kind of really locking the rules down.
Right. Yeah, it's a really good idea. I mean, it's kind of like the sealed crate motor stuff, like, you know, like Coyote Stock or CPS and MCA side. You know, you've got this one limiting factor that you can't touch, and it kind of puts – not necessarily, in this case, not – in the same ball field, but you'll be close. You know, you have the same power adder, so it's up to really everything else on the bottom of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a pretty sweet deal. I think they're a little bit lenient on the chassis as well. I saw where you can run ladder bars and stuff like that too. So, you know, somebody just had a lot of stuff was restricted to stock suspension and stuff like that. And so, you know, with this allowing ladder bars, and I don't know if it's aftermarket four links or not, but yeah, you know, somebody just has some chassis laying around that they want to slap a SF series radial 275 on it and small block of the plate, they can go race.
Oh yeah.
And it's pretty sweet. And you know, he's thrown a pretty good purse at it, and now he has some contingency sponsors coming in and throwing some prizes in there. You know, Donald really knows how to build something up. And I think he already has like 20 or so drivers already registered to be there, you know, at the next event. So it's pretty sweet. And I make a lot of memes for Donald, and I think the funniest one was the DXP Street, like, and all of a sudden there's the hands push a Disney character over, and it's like Ron Rhodes coming through the door or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some heavy hitter like Ron would come in there and, you know, just kick ass immediately, but hey, that's fine. I mean, you know, everybody has the same plate, so they have the same playing field. So,
well, you know,
I think, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you mentioned Ron, you start kind of poking around the X275 world like that. and you know, you get people that try to be innovative and push the rules, like the Bruder brothers. And you start, anytime you see those guys of, you know, like at that level, kind of wanting to get involved with something, you know that they're going to find a way to not cheat, but to maximize the rule book however way that they can.
Right. And then, you know, in those kinds of categories, that's what you've got to do. It's just how it is, you know. And then when they come in, hopefully nobody, if somebody like that comes in, hopefully no one gets discouraged. It may be more motivating. It would be discouraging to, you know, to run with those guys. And that's kind of how it was, you know, when I was racing Stock Eliminator, you know. It's like, well, these guys are all seasoned vets and stuff, and, you know, it makes you try harder. Oh, and so with DXP Street having that restricted plate and stuff, it makes it a little more approachable and reachable for somebody with a budget and be competitive.
Oh, yeah, they don't have to go out and spend thousands of dollars, you know, just to get a fogger setup started. And that doesn't include everything else, the R&D and, you know, the testing and everything else that goes into one of those systems. You know, it's there's a lot of hidden costs in heads-up racing that people think, well, when I say hidden costs, hidden knowledge costs. Because, you could have a fat wallet and buy all the best gear, but that doesn't mean you're going to know how to make it go fast.
I see that happen all the time.
Yeah.
It happens a lot.
And you see, you know, I mean, you even see it, I think, in a lot of like dot 90 racing in the NHRA or, you know, top sportsmen where guys will go out and they'll buy the best of everything, but they can't exactly drive a lick and they get scalped on the tree. And, you know, the dude, you know, the 20-year-old dragster just goes down there and staples them to the scoreboard with a, you know, a 90 with an O.
Yeah. Trips up and dead on. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. I love watching NHRA All Access now just because you get to hear Reinhardt and those guys talk about it, and you get to see the board. You get to just see how absolutely brutal some of those races you can be. You feel bad for some of those dudes that lose because it's just, you know.
Yeah, they probably put the best package together they've ever done. They still get put on the trailer.
Yeah, someone like Justin Land comes out and, you know, breaks one off in him, and it's like, well, you know, you picked a bad day to have a good run.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And, you know, kind of a question I like to throw out there to a lot of the people that are hardcore racers is, if you could run any other class, you know, you're given a magical checkbook that has unlimited funds behind it, and you're allowed to pick one class to race, what would it be?
Oh, man, that's tough. A lot of people are probably going to hate me, but I think, you know, pro stock, man, I think if the bodies, you know, resemble the cars a little bit more, but as far as, you know, there's just the naturally aspirated, ripping through the gears kind of class like that, I think pro stock would probably be the way I would go. And I'm not sure with the future state of that class, how it looks, but I just love that class and just how exciting and how just watching is exciting to me.
Oh, yeah.
I think pro stock, and then, you know, I would probably lean over toward the X275 side, because there's a lot you can do with those cars. I mean, you could run X275 and then you can go to a World Cup and run whatever class they have, you know, 4 mile stuff. And that's a whole other story there. That race is just insane too.
Yeah. I was very fortunate that I got to go back to the World Cup this year, and that's just the sheer variety of cars and the absolute insanity that event is, just across the board with the amount of people, how fast they're going. It's, you know, I used to, you know, people in my generation used to think imports were stupid. And then you start to see more well-built ones. And then you go to that event and you see some of those cars, and it is absolutely just mental what they're doing with those cars.
Right. I mean, those cars are legit. You know, they're not the guy you see at AutoZone, you know, putting the stick on vents on his car. You know, they're you know, these guys have been doing it for a long time. It's just crazy what they're running. Then you see, you know, you see your regulars that you see run the drag radial classes out there ripping out, you know, 650s in the quarter or fives, so, you know, 590s or whatever. It's just insane seeing, you know, the cars going the other half of the track.
Oh, yeah.
And
Yeah. Well, you get the some of those cars like in that Warriors versus Tres Cuartos class where it's like a little Toyota Starlet where the wheel tubs are touching each other in the back and on the roof, and those dudes are sawing through the gears, and those cars are going every which way but straight, and they don't lift. They are in it to win it.
Yeah, you see a lot of them on the roofs too. But, hey, that's because there's no wheelbase there, though.
No, the wheelie bars are literally as long as the car, and those things weigh like 1,200 pounds. But, I mean, it's impressive to watch, and like you were saying, you know, seeing some of those X cars and, you know, an LDR car or something like that run the full quarter mile, you know, that's very intense to watch.
Yeah, it just shows how much power they really are making. And it's just cool as can be seeing a lot of the full-body cars that aren't, you know, stretched out, and you know, you've got the stock roof line, stock quarters, and, you know, they're out there running what, you know, pro mods were running, you know, years ago, or even Top Fuel back in the 70s, or, you know, just the big dog classes, and we're out here with a radial tire out there now with a full-body car running the same thing.
Oh, it's nuts. Yeah. Yeah, it's, you see some of those cars come up, and the thing that honestly really kind of impressed me more about this event, though, were the dudes on the bikes. Those guys, hats off to them. They are more brave than I could ever hope to be going that fast on a bike in those conditions.
Yeah, I have to have a roll bar and four wheels. I'm sorry. I'm not getting on a bike that fast.
No, it's like Larry McBride going a 650 something on a Nitro Harley, and being around those things trackside, they always impress me and terrify me because it's the only class that you'll see guys putting body armor on to get on the bike.
Right.
You know, yeah. It's like, wow, you're actually wearing a ballistic vest. And
they have to have two guys just stretch out so long. They have to have two or three guys line them up on the track and hold them up until they stage.
Yeah. And the funny thing is they don't actually sit on those bikes when they go to start them up because that's like one of the biggest times they might explode, so they don't want to be laying on the bomb essentially, you know, which makes sense. But yet it's like, wow, that's a whole nother level of crazy. Well, Andy, our time here on the Drag Zine podcast is coming to an end, and you know, I like to give my guests their opportunity to do their best John Force impersonation and rip off who they want to thank and their sponsors and everything else and where they can be found at on social media and anywhere else. So I'll turn the floor over to you and let you do you and tell the fine folks where what's up and where's where.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I hope you have a while. First off, I'd like to thank my family, mom, dad, my brother, John, my wife, Shelby. Shelby has been a big part of the racing program the last couple of years since, you know, my dad and mom have had some health problems. So she's gone to every event with me and been my helping hand. And then, you know, John's been there too. My crew, Jeremy, Craig, Adam, there's just so many in the name. A lot of big sponsors on board this year, mostly, you know, like TRZ Motorsports and Fuel Lab and AFR, Ron Francis Wiring, E3, Lucas Oil, Ross Pistons, just the list goes on and on. Mickey Thompson, there's a long, long list, and then I'd be here all night boring everybody with sponsors. But I'm so grateful to have so many people involved in with such a, you know, it's a sportsman level class car, and I've got the professional level support on this thing, and it just means so much that, you know, I can get that kind of support doing what I do, and I can't thank them enough.
Now, can they find out more about your sponsors and anything else on any social media pages or anything like that for anybody you might have missed?
Sure, yeah. Our John and I's Facebook page is Warren Racing 270 is our area code. Warren Racing 270, or you can just find me on Facebook, just Andy Warren, and give me an ad, and I'll put you on there. And then I do a lot of product installs. I do some reviews and stuff like that too, so come check it out.
Awesome. Well, Andy, we appreciate your time, and you know, coming on the show and looking forward to seeing you at PRI and, you know, back at the track next year. And I'll put the word in for Walcott that he's got to name that trophy after you, since you just keep, since you just keep winning it. You know, it's just, they just need to just like give you one at all times.
Yeah, he's already made comments. He's like, yeah, I just might as well just, you know, just write the check when I get here for you. I was like, no.
Got to earn it, right? You got to earn it.
Well, I mean, I appreciate the time, and I look forward to seeing you.
Thanks again, Andy.
All right, man. Take care.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks to Andy for stopping by, and as always, may your reaction times be crisp and your win lights bright. Until next week, folks.